partnership.
Good, so we can continue.
So as well as coming to lunch there, come to the annual general meeting, and we could always go and talk to them, particularly to Mr. Slater. But we were almost virtually arm's length.
They were able to provide you with necessary capital when required?
We didn't approach them for cash, but I think really that they weren't there for that object. They were taking that as a sighting shot for the eventual Big Bang and so on, and it was a minuscule amount of money that they had there, but obviously with that backing, all the banks would have been happier to lend money if we needed it. But, we always kept fairly strictly within our limits, and if we said we would be closing a loan at any time, we always did so. Mm. So as I said at the beginning, virtually we had complete support all the time so I can remember, and we're going back to Mr. Archer's day, who was famous national bank manager, first class help, and they trusted us and we didn't let them down, and worked the other way around, so it's very satisfactory. And that's why I think that the capital problems were not as great as people always assumed in the jobbing system. If you had unlimited access to capital, I think it would have been very dangerous, because you would have had people possibly wanting to win their spurs and dealing in large amounts that made sense. And I've always had the feeling that any fool could be the market if you made the wrong price long enough and large enough, and I want to encourage people to take on sizable business, obviously, and always be known to be prepared to deal in size, but not to make it so ridiculous that just for the sake of prestige that they were going to lose money on it.
Now, at some point you became chairman. Were you the first chairman of this good bishop? And then towards the end of the 1970s, were you thinking about retiring?
Yes, I think by then... I suppose I was 55 when I so that I was a different generation. We had a first-class team in existence all raring to go, and I felt that the thing would be to nurse it till the change happened, and then it would be more sensible that I could go, then knowing that it would go very well, and that they would be much more competent to deal in the new world than I would be. So my object rather was really to keep it in play until that happened. And I think I've seen people who stayed on too long. I hope I didn't. And in many ways they became a nuisance, and they were tolerated, which was not a thing that I would like to be in. And I thought, well, right, it's my time to go now, and it's all set up to run, that's fine.
Now, reviewing your career as a partner after the war, how did the stock exchange change? Did the character of the stock exchange change?
It changed slowly to the degree that it became less personal, and fun was beginning to go out of it. There was much more the drive for the institutional businesses, and what one found particularly that the people, the brokers of one's own generation, were so busy in their offices that they very rarely came onto the floor of the house, so that one lost contact with them, unless either you saw them socially or perhaps wanted to go and talk to them about business or to sort out some problem. This gave rise to the importance of the senior dealer, who very often didn't get partnership status in the brokers until very late, but he was, in, as regards the floor of the house and the jobbing, of course, far more important by then than the partners. There were two there, there's Charles Pennell of Cazenove and Perkins of Greaves and Grant, were two that stand to mind, Colonel Side of Dizoot. They became, and I believe it was that Charles Pennell, who was doing enormous business which Cazenove had in very, very large size, and I think it was a jobber who mentioned to one of the Cazenove partners, well, you really, you ought to make him a partner because it's, I mean, we know all it well, but it, just he is doing this business and it would be better. And so he became a partner. I don't know whether that's true, but I think it was. I hit it on.
But right up to the end, you were dealing yourself on the floor.
I was dealing till fairly late on, and then occasionally if somebody is away, I'd stand in. But I'd seen the disasters which a senior partner could do by going on dealing too long. Mm. I can remember there were two new issues on the same day, and one I had partners decided that he would do it, and he was dealing with Cazenove, and I kept trying to interrupt. They were closeted on the seat, and I was to run by and book sort of a yard away. And eventually, I said, well, you're dealing in the wrong stock. So his partner literally blasted me off the face of the earth. And we checked it, and he was dealing in the wrong stock. So that had to be undone. And there were one or two other cases, because old Charles Pennell was a contemporary of head partner, and he would very often have large business, and he would go up with to him and say, ah, Harry, I waited till you all perhaps gone to lunch. Far sooner deal with you for old times. And when you came back, you could just see, God, what's happened now, and pick up the book, and something absolutely terrible had happened. He sort of completely undone everything I'd been trying to do. So I thought, well, Brian Winterflood's had been working with me, and he'd built up. We were still in garages, which was a fairly small part. And when he was with me, he specialised in that and built it up into a sort of great money spinner, as he did later on with the USN. So I thought it was more sensible to drop out gracefully and not suddenly interfere and wreck the thing.
Well, let's now cover some of those additional points on which you've prepared.
Right, now,
a few notes.
Well, one of your topics was the type of people who became jobbers.
Yes.
And I think really the answer is that anyone, any type, if they could make money. You had, for instance, jobbers like Sir Nigel Mordaunt, as a baronet, Durlackers, Dick Wilkins and so on, and all in their way successful, because there are many ways in which one can succeed as a jobber. It's not a stereotype jobber. And we picked up a chap who had been a petrol pump attendant, and one of our directors was so impressed with his speed, in just at the time, I think it was a change of decimalisation or to litres, that he said, well, you know, you've really got the brain, would you like to come on the stock exchange? And he did extremely well. So, you know, the people from, you could say, every type and class is a word I've never really believed in, but from every different backgrounds, and if they could make the money, that's fair enough. The qualities, I think, I think you had to have a reputation for honesty was one of the most important, and for discretion, because if a broker felt his business was being blabbed about, then he wouldn't come back again, quite obviously. So I think that was important. Then on oneself, a job, you had to have, be able to make up your mind really quickly, far faster than a computer, to, if there was a takeover suddenly got announced on the screen, you had to feed into your brain your position, position of your opposition, money involved, and spin out a price within seconds, because you would have perhaps 20 or 30 people shouting round you. Most of them just wanted the price, but one or two of them might have known what they wanted to do, and so you had to get, you probably made a slightly wider price and then narrowed it as you got the feel that the price was right. Now you had, and I think also you had to have bottom, because if you had a bad position, there was no good crying over it. There was no good sort of cutting it straight away. If it was a bad one, okay, you had to cut it and start again. If you thought it was right, you had the bottom to stick with it and nurse it along, and by the time, yeah, the trouble was occasionally that if it was too big, then you would to free your cash positions, because we, and I think probably most firms did, you had a very rough idea of how much money would be allocated to each sector. And if they overran it for a time, it was okay, make arrangements. If on the other hand it was permanently, and obviously something going wrong, then you had to, as a partner, say, right, okay, you know, could take some action on that and cut this position back, whether they liked it or not. Usually they didn't, but it was too bad.
How would you go about doing that?
Well, I think it was the same. I was quite sure the Ford deal was going to be taken over, the British Ford. My information was very good. I had a bull position. I'd taken money for the call, which I'd covered in full, and I'd taken some double money, which I'd also covered that. So I had much too much exposure to this takeover of Ford. And the head partner at the time, I didn't, decided it was too big anyway. So I then had to cut the position, and just said, well, cut it. And I'd say, head partner says, cut it. I've had to do it myself in my time. You just said to cut it. That was just a great pity. I didn't lose any money on it, but I mean, it was a coup which didn't happen.
Did you mark your price down?
I didn't mark it down, but I found that the people who wanted to buy, there were two firms in England. I think they're probably buying some for the Americans. And so I offered them stock and tell them, you know, I can sell a bit, and when they wanted to buy, come and see me. So it didn't take very long, actually. I suppose it was two or three days. I got the thing down to what was then accepted as being okay.
So you were actually able to go out and find buyers. You had buyers in mind.
Yes, I knew who were buying.
So jobbing simply wasn't one of them the case was a chap waiting for them to come to you.
It's a two-way stretch. If you wanted to make business with, which would usually mean that you were going to change the price, the market price, because you would then go and see a broker that you thought might be interested, and you could say they're £6. Six and a half to three quarters. Well, I've got a seller, I might be able to sell at the middle price, which would be 6 5/8. The chap said, no, I could do that, but I'll give you £6.12. Well, so thus you would be making business, or he would come along to you, and if he sort of had business, then he would approach the market. But you could make business by going to see and by making a different proposition, which is what I had to do.
You said that your information on Ford was good. What were your sources of information, just generally? How did a job go about?
A chap was buying them and said, no, I think my chap knows what he's doing. This was also a thing that happened in those days. I suppose everybody now would be up before the beaks for insider trading, but in the old days, of course, markets were made in certain stocks very often by the directors dealing. In fact, they would either buy or sell shares, not necessarily taking advantage of the market, but sometimes they would knew something was going to happen. And the broker, you deal with him and he'd buy a couple of thousand shares, and you're walking off the pictures and everything about these. That's not a good bargain you've done. And you said, right, thanks very much. Say, right, I'll cut a couple of hundred, 250, 500 pounds on this. Go on the other tack if you knew the chap was, you know, genuine and trying to help you. So now, and equally, of course, where directors had quite a large stake in the business, which were, I suppose, which they'd built up, it was very useful if you had a buyer or a seller, you could go along to the what was known as the shop broker and say, well, look, I've got some business in this. Can you interest anybody on the board? And he would go along and say, right, there's prices such and such. But there's a big buyer, and if you could, you know, if you'd like to offer some stock, I'll see what I can get. Mm-hmm. And I suppose if Drake, you know, had sort of 100,000 shares and was thinking of buying a new car, he said, well, okay, I'll sell 10,000 such and such price. So you immediately had a limit down which you could build a business. Or you might say, right, well, thanks so much, I'll take those. Mm-hmm. And then the price went down a month later. You would remember back of your mind this chap had sold it. What should we say, 76 shillings, and they were now 69 bob offered. You go to the broker and say, well, look, now you sell them at 76 bob, there's 69 bob offered, I'll offer you 10,000. And I'd like to approach him, so he would go off. Worked very well, the director had made some money, the broker had made some commission, and you were turning your business over. Mm-hmm. Of course, that I fear is no longer the case. In fact, I'm not sure that they don't. They refuse to accept limits now, I believe.
They being the...
Well, the market makers.
Yes.
But in the old days, limits on your book were very useful. Mm. Firm limits especially, because you knew they were there and you could deal on them. Mm. Indicated limits at least gave you some idea of if the market went better where you might find shares, or went down where you might find somebody wanted to buy them.
Mm. And this all helped keep the market liquid?
All kept the market liquid.
Were there any other now?
As I was saying, virtually all our partners, really from 1931, had all made their way through the ranks. I think, you know, without any influence, they were merely because they were able to make money and
yes.
reasonable. So we've done that.
So, again, looking back over your career, how would you describe the character of the different markets in the stock exchange?
Well, I think they all had a character of their own. You can think of the gilt market, where obviously it was very much top-hatted, certainly in the old days, involving the government broker, discount houses. And it was a, shall we say, more restrained and gentlemanly market. Whereas if you take the gold market, which and the transatlantic market, the Americans, there would be a tremendous amount of excitement in the dealing, partly it was generated to make business, partly because the movements could be very violent, much more violent than there would be in the gilts. I think there was a smaller sector of the market, I'm thinking in particular of the leisure, where the shop operated a lot. In other words, stocks as Butlins and in the early days, Ladbrokes and these sort of people. The business was very much on their way up, done by the people connected with the company. So that had its own type of market, and the shop were often quite active in it. The oil market, you had the mixed bag because you had a lot of English investment as good institutions interested, and world leaders like what became BP, the old Anglo-Iranian, Shell, Ultramar, and also there were continental interest in that, and again transatlantic. So you had a general interest, a real sort of international market was sort of there. In the industrials, you had a very mixed bag because it covered such a wide range. You had small companies, every type of company, and of course the very large ones, Imperial Chemical, I suppose, were always the share that everybody knew about on the stock exchange. And if they, in those days, if they moved more than tuppence or threepence in a day, felt the world had come to an end. It was just so steady in markets. You had the brewery market, which was, again, I suppose, one of the ones that was very lucrative. There were two big jobbers in it. And the build-up, first of all, the build-up for the takeovers. And then there were companies, which Whitbread particularly, were regarded as what they think they call them white knights nowadays, but they bought in early so that they could prevent, they would have a hold in, would make it very difficult to take over. So they had their specialist markets, and they were big markets in those days, of course, in the sort of company of what Coombe size being taken over, it was a tremendous amount of business. And I suppose to a slight degree the practitioners did make something of the market. I don't think it was really the open outcry market, although occasionally when Dunlop declared its dividend, there was one jobber who always used to go into the middle and shout loudly what he thought would be the right price for a minute or two before retiring. I think it was not really so much the intention of dealing particularly as keeping the tradition going and saying he was the market and the shares. So, and I think one should perhaps make the comment that as the broking firms got larger, employing more people, they tended to have dealer in who was well versed in these markets. Smaller firms, there were one or two characters who were quite incredible to my mind, that they knew the touch price in and could go and deal in any market. They could go and deal in the gilt market and again go into the gold market, which was something completely different altogether, wider prices and very funny prices and so on, trying to catch out the clients. And in the end, it became really necessary for brokers of any size to have experts in the various markets.
Have we covered most of the markets?
So I think we've covered, those are the ones that I think, you know, stand out, because there's an Australian market, frankly, I don't know anything about. And I never came into contact with it. But I would have said it had much the sort of characteristics of the South African mining market, but in a much smaller way, except when you had Poseidon and over Christmas, but it was moving at just an incredible rate. People went out, I think, to have their sort of first drink on Christmas Eve, came back, found the price had risen so much they decided to go back and have a second. By the time they'd come back from that, they'd found it had dropped They had to go out and have a third to drown their sorrows. But there were a few shares like that, but I think that covers the sort of markets. Yes. And with, as I say, with the people in them, they did tend to make the type of market.
Now, there was something you wanted to say about relations with brokers.
Yes, I thought this, obviously, you had to be able to get on with brokers, otherwise they were your source of business. Mm-hmm. And I think although it could be probably fairly said that they did deal on the best terms for the client, equally, if they had the choice of dealing and they disliked you intensely, and they could do as well elsewhere, or even if they couldn't on the price quoted, but they could open to the other jobber and say, well, Joe Bloggs is bidding a penny halfpenny more than you do. Do you want to compete with him? And they weren't supposed to open jobber's books, but time to time they did. Then the job would say, oh, yes, of course, I will. I think in a few cases, I think brokers and jobbers got perhaps a bit too close, but I mean, it was the rub of the green. I don't think that the Catholics tended to deal with the Catholics more than anybody else, whether that's because they were good dealers or not.
What were the problems with brokers becoming too close to jobbers?
Well, you like jobbers are fairly sensitive in the way of reacting violently to anything they feel or think. Not necessarily true, but reacting to what they think might be true, that they would be very hurt. They felt one broker was deliberately feeding all his business to somebody else and they weren't getting a sniff of it. They could ructions if, on the other hand, that broker was doing best for his clients, there's nothing the jobber could do. So, which comes back to the thing that you had to be fairly friendly and with the brokers, because after all, they were where your business was coming from. You couldn't, as a jobber, certainly officially, you couldn't go outside to an operator who was a member of the public or an institution and set up a deal. So you rather had to wait for it to come via the broker. And I think that also it was sensible. I always tried to make people welcome as it would, coming onto your pitch, same as they come into your house. You try and help them. There are certain brokers that you knew would going to fleece you if they could. Well, it was fair enough, and if you were fool enough to fall for it, that was your fault. I remember learning that very early in my career as a dealer, there was a very unmarketable stock, and the system of no buying in, which meant that it dropped out in the end, but at that time you sell the stock that you didn't have. And if there was not a free market in it, or very, very limited market, you could say, well, I haven't got them. I won't deal, but I'll deal not to press, which was that you wouldn't try and complete the bargain immediately, or what was much stronger, no buying in, not to buy in. That meant that the broker could not take advantage of the stock exchange system whereby you could put up a stock if it hadn't been delivered to the broker. The broker could go to the department and say, I want to buy these shares in, and they would have to be bought in at more or less whatever price there was. So there's one chap, and he particularly wanted to buy, I think if I'm right, my memory serves back those years, it was Austin 20% preferred. And anyway, I eventually sold him 500 shares. And he said, I'll give you my word, I won't press you. So at the end of the account, I was rather shaken. My office rang up and said, oh, so-and-so, pressing for delivery of these Austin 20s. So I said, bloody nonsense. He told me he wouldn't do it. I told him I didn't have them. So I sent for him, and I came up, and he said, oh, yes, my client wants these shares. Wants his name. So I said, well, you gave me your word, you wouldn't. He said, my boy, you'll never trust my word. It'll save you a lot of money. So I eventually cut 3 shillings a share on the 500, and I learnt my lesson. So I reckon that over the years it was cheaper the price.
How did you get out of that situation?
I found somebody who had the stock. They were, I think, 28 shillings. Mm-hmm. And he said, well, I'll sell 531 shillings. And it was quite a big amount of dividend to go on, paying out, and having just sort of bought in. So I bought the 500 and said thanks very much and cut my throat.
Mm. It might be good at this point to explain contangos.
Oh, yes.
Carrying over.
In the old days, at the end of the account, there was not, in fact, I'm not sure whether there was cash in there, I remember the contangos because we used to have to come up on the Saturday when it was the last day of the account, when we were open on Saturday, every fortnight. And it would then go through.